Okay, so we'll continue with this final lecture in our series, Jung and the Wizard in Modern Culture. There is a curious inclination in human nature to explore, to wish to cross the hill seen to see what is beyond, to know the unknown. All of my life, I've found myself somewhat fascinated with maps. Old maps. The new maps, where everything is just sort of totally laid out with a global positioning system, metric accuracy, don't interest me that much. But the old maps, where people were trying to fill in the last blanks, did and continue to interest me. I have one such map on my dining room wall that I've had now for 25 years. Back in the 1930s, there was probably one last blank on the map, or one of a few, in the center of the Karakoram mountain range on the borders of Pakistan and China. And an explorer by the name of Eric Shipton went in there in the year 1937, spent about a year exploring and mapping this last area. It was an area that I went to myself some years later to climb. The mountain K2 is right in the center of that area. And I loved his map in a way because it was incomplete. There are areas he didn't investigate. They were still open places. And when I went into K2, into this area of the Shaxcam, of the Karakoram, in 1986, it was actually this map that I most enjoyed using because it was a bit imprecise. And there were areas on it that he had not seen. It left, as it were, a potential open to see the unseen, to discover for one's self. In the old, in the most ancient of maps, we often find the contours of the land known and the land unknown slowly merging into each other. If you look at the maps, say, drawn, in the late Middle Ages, you'll find with some precision the shapes of the landmass of Italy and Europe. And then as you get more and more to the fringes, the contours, while still drawn, become more imaginal, shall we say, how they relate to this map drawn with complete satellite accuracy of our own day. Well, they depart considerably from that. And then ultimately, at the edges of the earth, there is this unknown region. I remember one old map from the Middle Ages, where there at the fringes, the words written are Ultima Thule. There be dragons. Ultima Thule means the ultimate ends of the earth. Thule was a mystical place conceived by, I think, Roman cartographers as being about 6 days ship sail north of Britain. It was the ultimate northern land. And the Ultima, the ultimate Thule, the ultimate land, was always seen as that place just beyond the boundaries, the last place you could go. But the last place you could go, you see, was, well, it was just beyond what had ever been seen. Just beyond whatever had been seen was the ultimate last place to see. Well, since the Age of Discovery, a period, perhaps beginning in the 15th century as we define it, the human globe, Earth, has been well investigated, well explored. By 1937, when Shipton went into the Karakoram, the northern Karakoram, there were very few blanks on the map. And now I'd say they've all been filled in with our satellite technology, our global positioning system, our GPS localizers. Every last speck of this Earth has been well investigated and well mapped. You know, but at the same time, these last blanks on the map were being filled in. A different kind of modern explorer began a very different journey into unknown realms.
Right here.
My family. So, in the past few weeks, I've attempted to share what I consider to be the essentials, a key, a magical key to understanding the psychology, the teaching of Carl Jung. But I haven't spoken very specifically about the map that he brought back from his explorations. I've talked about the fact that the man explored the psyche, but I haven't said a darn thing about exactly what, he determined from his explorations. What was the map this explorer brought back from his ventures? And to that, I feel I must give a bit of time tonight. I'd like to give you, an outline of a map brought back by an explorer of the unknown, an explorer of the psyche and its hidden depths, as the plaque engraved upon the home of Jung's birth states it. Jung's map of the psyche starts with, the known land. Every map does, you know. Every one of those old maps has a place well known, a place whose contours are fairly well defined, simply by the fact that we live there most of the time. We walk around it. We see it. We pace it off. That place of beginning of this psychology, Jung called the I. Well, in German, he called it the Ich, I. For some reason, when these words were translated to English, I became ego, a Greek word meaning I. This island of ourself, we know it, or at least we think we know it. It is a coagulum of stardust that has somehow arisen from the depths of cosmic chaos and been given a name. We have it. We know it. We walk around in it. I've often thought that the ich is a much better word for it than the ego. Especially after about age 40, when you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and you encounter this ego self, and the ich, it comes flowing forward in a natural fashion as a descriptor of what we encounter in ourselves. And I think most of us, as well as we know ourselves, what we know often evokes this ick. The mystery of how this ego arises, it's a mystery. But in some fashion, out of the stardust of billions of years, there has arisen this little island, this little coagulum that we call me and you. As this island of consciousness comes into relationship with the world, it starts in its relationships to develop opinions about itself. The opinions can be damaging occasionally. They can be ennobling. But the ego, usually at some point in its socialization process, finds it necessary to develop and the word that Jung used was, a persona, a way of relating to the world, a mask of relationship. This I, the tender flesh of what I am is sensitive. It's delicate. It's easily injured. It's bruised. It's burned by the flames of judgment, the fires of this world. Sometime, usually in our late childhood and adolescent years, we find the need to cover it up a little bit, to protect it, to shield it a bit. And so we develop a mask. In old Greek drama, this mask was called the persona. The smiling face, the frowning face of tragedy and comedy that you see in theatrical representations. These are the persona, the masks. In adolescent years, we often see young children becoming adults seeking for their own identity in the world. And, you know, the self, it's a pretty delicate thing. It's difficult to expose it. It's tender. And so they start go grabbing for various masks in some fashion to identify them, to denote who they are, and in a way also to shield them from the judgments of the world. You see this very frequently. As we go on in our lives, often we develop very specific masks. The mask of the profession. You know, we are the doctor, or we are the lawyer, or we are the produce manager, or we are the therapist, or we are a mask often which we take into ourselves in adolescence. We are the eternal rebel. We are the ironic cynic. You know, the masks have different lines on their faces. As I go in to take care of patients, often in just the first few seconds of an interaction, you get an entire story of a person by the mask that has been welded onto the skin of their face. It's hard to define. I don't think anyone could ever write a book about it. But you see it. There's a mask there. You see the mask of sadness, of satisfaction, of dissatisfaction, of chronic trauma, of chronic stress. You see it there. Well, you know, we all need a mask because we are delicate little things. We need some shield from this world. But the problem with the persona, well, first of all, it is a mask. The problem with it is often we forget that it is a mask. And we start identifying who we are with this artificial device welded upon our faces. And in these cases, we find the insufferable doctor, the insufferable lawyer, the people who are so impressed by the mask they wear, the academic mask, the mask of financial success, of social respectability, of, well, the mask of the caring, giving pastor and priest, whatever it be. They get so welded into the mask that all of a sudden you start wondering, who the hell the real person is? I mean, how often do you meet these people who are so much masked that you just sit there wondering, so what in the world is this person really? And yet, you know, it seems that the person themselves is so welded to the mask, they have no idea. They are so protected in that mask that they too are unaware of who or what they might be. And then occasionally you also meet an individual who has so many masks, they amaze you. These are often very magical individuals. They're also a bit of tricksters, and they can be quite irritating because you never know exactly what mask you're going to get at any one particular moment. The masks keep changing so fast that sometimes you're left, with vertigo, with a certain nausea, dizziness, trying to figure out which one is which today. Well, you know, by the time most of us reach our middle years, and personally I'm hoping those middle years fall someplace between 35 and 45, you see, because if you multiply by 2, that gives you a final solution to the answer. So I'm hoping that middle point is 35, but it's quite clear that in some lives it's earlier, and in some lives it's later. It's a variable thing. But sometime by whatever defines adulthood for us, maturity, we come to a point, at least some of us do, where we're tired of the mask and we're really curious about who it is that's looking back at us, that ich we find in the mirror. You know, we have ourselves defined to ourselves, perhaps, defined maybe in large part by the reflection we get in others' eyes. We have ourselves defined by social situations, by marital situations, or lack thereof, by job, or lack thereof. We have ourselves defined, carved out. And then in some lives there comes a moment, and in my own experience this is pretty common, sometime between the age of 35 and 45, and if it hasn't happened by then, sometime in the next several years is probably going to be a terrible eruption of sorts, one type or another, called midlife crisis. We come to a point where we really want to know who it is behind the mask. And then when we take the mask off and look, we see that we really want to even know more. Ego, persona. Two of the key points, two of the known lands on the map Jung created of the human psyche. When we come to that point, that dangerous, treacherous point, where the persona and the ego yearn to know a forgotten self, a forgotten sister, brother, we come to that most dangerous beginning of the work that Jung defined in his psychology. The old alchemists to whom Jung referred for examples of his psychological process called this period, this point in the work, the destruido, the solutio. It was the destruction. It was the beginning of what was known as the dark phase of the work, the negredo. You see, before the work can begin, before this work can begin, of stripping away the mask, of exploring this self and its deeper depths, first of all, well, we have to undo the assumptions. If I am more or different or other than I have been assumed to be, both by myself and others, well, I suppose I'll have to abandon what I thought I was. I'll have to abandon this mask. I'll have to abandon these internal definitions. I'll have to take them and throw them into a crucible. I'll have to take a mortar and a pistol, and I'll have to grind them up. I'll have to take the picture of myself upon the wall that defines me and throw it in a fire and turn it to black ash. You know, this is a painful process. It's really painful to strip ourselves of the assumptions, ours and others. And the alchemists rightly called this a dark work. But the dark work was only the beginning. The dark work was the first work. It led to a dark night in which the known was no more. Rather like that walk on a dark lane where the road itself disappears. The trees, the hallmarks are gone. And only in that darkness, so the old alchemist thought, and so Jung indeed echoes in his psychology, only in that darkness can we begin to find the true light. When we open ourselves to the possibility that there is something more going on in us, well, we're opening eyes and ears to a different realm. We're turning from light to dark, and in the dark, we're seeking light. Out of this destruido, this destruction, this dark phase of the work, came what the old alchemists called the albedo, the whitening, the lightning. If in our lives we get to this point and decide that we are going to, shall we say, leave the Shire, we've had a visit perhaps from an old wizard, a strange old guy, lots of fireworks, funny hat, comes by the house one day and knocks and says, "My son, seems that you are in possession of a strange ring. Well, we can't say much about it, but I think it's time to take a walk." And so we begin the walk, not knowing why, not knowing what the ring be, not knowing what the path may lead towards, but we leave the Shire, that I know, We crawl through a hole in the old great hedge and begin upon a path of mysteries. When we get there, suddenly, in my own experience and what I've witnessed in others, dreams, imaginings, synchronicities start twinkling at us like little sparks in the night. You know, we never would have seen them. They're little sparks. Blinded by the bright light of the sun, the bright light of our own conscious recognition of who we are, we may ignore them entirely. Only when we let that bright light darken can the twinkles of that interior world be seen. Fireflies are not seen in the light of day. They come at night. And so Jung suggested that there comes a point where we will really turn. I remember the story that Gregory Santos, my own dear friend and an analyst of sorts, told me about himself. And I'm sure he would not mind at all my retelling this story, because he told it himself in public many times. He was a Trappist monk. He decided at probably age 12 or so that he'd become a priest. And he'd gone into the monastery up in Huntsville, I think when he was 18 or 19. And he had spent 20 years as a Trappist monk, essentially not talking, strict observance, studying the old medieval masters. And he told me that when he decided in midlife that he was going to go off to Zurich and become a Jungian analyst, this was about 1975, that when he arrived in Zurich, he had no conscious memory of ever having had a single dream in his entire life. He went in, it's the fact that he would have been picked up by the claws of that great eagle and dragged off to Zurich is itself strange under these circumstances. He sat down with his first analyst, and he was analyzed by both Maria Louise von Franz and by Anneli Jaffe and by Karl Mayer, three of Jung's most notable disciples. And he sat down and he made this confession that he'd never had a dream. He wasn't exactly sure what he was doing there or what he was going to do. And he was advised to, see what happens tonight. And that night, he had a dream. And over the next year or two, I think he cataloged some hundreds of dreams that he brought in to analysis. Now, what was the difference? Had the dreams not been there before? Or had the observer, the witness to the dreams, not been there? You see, bringing ourselves present as witness into conscious relationship with this darkness, turning our eyes towards the twinkles, our eyes accustom to darkness. They open and they start to see. This period of the albedo, the whitening, is an exciting time. It was to the alchemists. They had taken their prima materia, they had tortured it, ground it, blackened it, and finally, after years of effort, there in the alembic, under the slow, steady flame, they started to see things. The twinkles. The dragons. And so it can be for us. Dreams come to us, and all of a sudden, for the first time, we are witness. We start writing them down. We start wondering about them. Sometimes the imagination becomes active. And the little fragment of a myth, a little fragment of a fantasy that would have passed by us unnoticed before, suddenly gets our notice. We find in it a story. Synchronicities start to happen. What is a synchronicity? It's when in some amazing fashion the outward world echoes our inward world without any causal connection. I remember just one example, maybe two examples of this. I remember one night many years ago when I was just struggling with the darkest demons, what seemed to be really the vampires of my own soul. And I had been up all night just going through hell. And I in the morning. We had a little guest house in our house at that time in Southern California. In the morning, I opened the door of this little old rickety guest house to walk out into the dawn of a new day. And there, laying in front of the door of this little guest house, writhing in death agony, was a huge bat. It just, well, I can't explain the emotion because that was, it was just, you know, like the demonic presence there, this struggling, probably half-dead rabid bat. Synchronicity. Something is going on internally and it is witnessed externally. There's another story I'll tell of that I think is so interesting. I've told it before and some of you have heard it, but it's one of the most amazing synchronicities that I know of. There's a woman who was struggling with a book of symbols, sitting in her room, reading about serpent mythology. And this is a point of real alivening in the psyche for this individual. And she was reading through the symbol dictionary because she had the sense of something going on with snakes. And been reading the various things about snakes and struggling with things all morning long. Finally, she, you know, it wasn't making a whole lot of sense to her. She felt presence, but not maybe complete connection. And so she took a break. Around the middle of the day, she walked out on her patio. And there's a path that went down this patio that was covered by an arbor of trees that went over from top to bottom, this sort of long arbor path. This is in Southern California also. And she went walking down the arbor. She looked up, and there to her right, in the tree, was a snake. A huge snake. And she had never really seen a snake in a tree, and she hadn't seen one there for sure. And by gosh, by golly, her immediate inclination was, I want to pick it up. I want to touch it. But of course, it was a snake. And it was in a tree, and so she was really just, can't do that. And so she went back in the house and tried to forget this. And couldn't. She had this sense that something had been missed, that she really had to go back out there, and she had to encounter this serpent. And she just, you know, promised that if I go back out there, the serpent's there, I'm going to pick that thing up, I'm going to see what happens. And just, you know, and how could I let such a thing pass? I just have to do that. Well, she walked out and looked up in the tree, and the serpent was gone. It wasn't there. And it was like, oh my God, how could I let such an opportunity pass? I should have done that. Oh, I'll never let such a thing happen again. I'll never let these opportunities pass. And then she looked to her left, and there was the snake. It had crawled up over the arbor and was now on the other side of this path. Okay, now she was stuck, right? Made all these promises, all these vows. So she reaches out, grabs the snake, picks it up. And her description was that the snake seemed like a friendly snake. And she had a rather loose blouse on, and the snake insinuated itself into her blouse and sort of wrapped itself around her. And then she looked at the snake and thought, my God, it's trying to seduce me. Now, it was probably a gopher snake. They get big. Now, all of a sudden, you see, there's a synchronicity. You're struggling with some theoretical concept. You can't quite get it right. You can't. And then you go out, and nature, the world itself, in a completely acausal, I mean, there's no explanation, there's no causality for this, right? It just happens. It's a random fact that falls in wondrous synchrony, paced together in time with the internal world, and somehow amplifies that internal world through its event. So for this individual, obviously, the encounter with the snake and its symbolism, well, the snake is trying to seduce me, snake in the tree. All of a sudden, all of these archetypal mythological realms open up through a synchronous event. And this is something that happens in the albedo. And you can see why the alchemists might call it the white phase, because it is really exciting. But you know, it has to go somewhere. As this activation of the archetypes takes place, in Jung's psychology, and here I should say it as I tell this story, I'm really reflecting to you one addition, one brief vision of Jung's map of the process, of the psychological journey. In this process, as in this activation, when we turn ourselves to this darkness and come into conscious encounter with it, there are some figures which universally seem to appear. One is the trickster, or the wizard. The wise old man, he might have been called. And he is actually quite a trickster, as well as being wise. There's another image that almost universally appears at some point in this process, perhaps in its more advanced stages. And that was the appearance of what Jung called the contra-sexual image, the anima, or the animus. It's rather like the half of ourselves that we were missing comes looking for us. Our true mate. If we are masculine, very often that image comes as feminine. For the feminine, quite often in a masculine form. It is the half of ourselves that was missing. And when this image appears, often it comes with a great deal of, shall we say, love, even sexual force. It seems as if there's a longing for union. Now, what I've found and what I have witnessed documented by others, this is a dangerous process, you see. Because as we encounter these figures of the unconscious, we still remain in relationship with the outer world. Though we may turn ourselves to the internal, there is still an external that we deal with. And it's quite common for us when these interior forces start to activate for us to project them outward. And so perhaps we're in relationship with an analyst. And suddenly this analyst starts becoming extremely wise, a godlike figure, a person who we really depend on, who is indeed our guide, our Gandalf. And we start putting these interior facts upon the exterior person. In fact, we see them more clearly reflected outward and projected onto an exterior individual than we do within ourselves. When this happens in Jungian psychology, this transference, this projection, it is, of course, the analyst's duty to recognize it and to somehow help guide the transference back to its true source within. That can be a dangerous and difficult road. The transference takes, of course, other forms. This contrasexual image often is projected outward. I think most of us maybe not most of us, I really don't know. I know myself, let me just speak from my own experience, that in adolescence, there was that one young woman, inaccessible, who seemed like she would be the completion of every dream, of everything that I needed. Of course, such things never happen. This love projection. Often, at some point as we emerge into consciousness, this first contrasexual image is projected outward on some figure. In some disastrous cases, we marry that individual. And in other extremely fortuitous cases, we marry that other individual. Sometimes it is the right magic. But, again, when these forces start developing within ourselves, the contrasexual image can come into play. Suddenly there is a man or a woman who it seems as if is our completion. Not only is that person inside, that thing inside us, but it's outside. And what we need to do is we need to unify with it in the exterior world. This is the great mysterium conjunctionis. This is the alchemical work. Somehow it's in this love relationship, outwardly. You know, this often happens, I'd say, in the obstructed midlife crisis, where the interior never really gets quite realized. And all of a sudden, at age 48, you have the lawyer leaving his BMW in the driveway and buying a red Porsche and driving off into the sunset with the young waitress from the 7-Eleven. And you know, it's the animal. There's this need for a change, transformation, a fracture of what was, this destruction of the persona, projection out on the anima, and off we go. Of course, it's usually a disaster. Because, you see, it was all projected outward. The work with the analyst, with the guru, with the teacher, can also end up being disastrous, you know. Oh, how many people have you and I known who are just absolutely enthralled with a specific teacher or their guru? I mean, this was more common, I guess, in the 60s and 70s when Indian, you know, Asian stuff hit us, but it still exists. Or their lecturer, or their God knows what, their analyst, their doctor, whatever. They are absolutely enthralled with this individual. This individual knows everything. This individual is really helping them. This individual has finally showed them the true path. And then you cross their way a couple years later, and all you hear is, that fellow was just a charlatan, a bag of poop. He deceived me, but I've found somebody else now. I've got a. You see, what's going on here? Because this transference, this projection of an inward process outward, well, you know, unfortunately, there are very few true wizards in this world. And though we would see them, we would concretize them with our projection, with our transference, hey, they are all bags of 24 feet of that stuff. You know, every single one of us, you, me, all of us, we're human, we're flesh, and we have our failings. Boy, do we have our failings. And you see, when the transference goes outward, and it's never appropriately resolved, it's never skillfully turned backwards, inwards, returned properly to its place. When it's fractured, often what there is in the place of love, there's hate. What was good, what was profitable, what was magical, is now sinful, dangerous, and a total deception. And this is often how the Jungian therapeutic alliance, shall we say, would break. It's also how many of our relationships with guides, wizards in this world, break. It's also how sometimes what we call love breaks. Maybe this person who you see across the room, who meets your eyes, who you think is the object of your ultimate desire, well, after 3 or 4 days or months or years with this individual, the transference breaks, and what you see is that this is a human being. And by gosh, by golly, a flawed one too. How could that happen to me? They snore. They don't think of me first. They don't satisfy every desire I have, and somehow or another they aren't my ultimate unification. They don't make me whole. How could they fail to make me whole? The dangers, the transference, the projections that come in this process. The point was, as Jung made clear in his psychology, is that outward and inward, they play. They do play. You know, there are individuals, there are analysts, there are gurus, teachers, who really do have a bit of the alchemical stone's dust upon them. There are people in this world who really do hold within themselves a mirror of something special. But the magic of these individuals, and they are rare, they are few, the magic of these individuals is when we look into the mirror that they are, and we see a wonder, when we see a glory, that mirror, however flawed it may be in its own flesh, returns to us the true image of what we are. It takes none of it for itself. It is not a vampire. Vampires don't see themselves in mirrors, you know. They just suck blood. And there are a lot of teachers out there that are like that. They would like to stand up. They would like to take it all in. Because it inflates, it fills them with this life blood of adoration. The true mirror, the true wizard, doesn't need it. Because they are already whole. And that mirror of individual, reflects back a true image true potential, of the true spark within the human. Now, they are rare. They are rare. But they are. Of course, every analyst in the Jungian tradition would hope to be such a thing if they ever understood it. But perhaps never having met it, very few of them do. And so on this journey, as we come through the doorway of confrontation with our own shadow selves, our own dark ego realms, as we come in recognition of the persona that we have cast aside, as we meet in the lightning the archetypes of the unconscious, these primary forms, as we come to the yearning for union, we come in approach to what was in the alchemical process called the red stage, the rubedo, the stage of life, the color of the royal wedding. And here some very few, come to the threshold of a great mystery. In venturing into the psyche, in passing through the keepers of the thresholds, the many images and the trickster quality those images may have, the deceptive trickster quality, in passing through the challenges of perhaps reflecting the work entirely into the crucible of this world, into relationships with others in this world. Having passed through that trial, they come to see that the work is truly happening in them. However much it may happen outside, it's in there. And what awaits them is a true brother, a true sister, a true bridegroom. Something that has awaited them from before time, from the day before creation, from an ever-present moment before creation. In Jung's last great alchemical work, which he called Mysterium Conjunctionis, he spends a vast amount of effort trying to explain how this process was seen by the old alchemists. He uses the work of a late philosophical alchemist, I think, whose name is Gerhard Dorn, and I think Dorn was writing in the late 1500s, if I remember correctly. And Dorn talks about the phases of the work, you know, this first phase, the second phase, the third phase, the dark phase, the white phase, the red phase. And here he's talking about that, the second phase, the albedo, which he calls the unio mentalis, the union of the mind, the union of the mind with the unconscious products, the relationship of the mind with the unconscious. And Jung makes comment. He says, the third, for him, the third and the highest degree of conjunction, for Dorn, the highest degree of conjunction was the union of the whole man with the unus mundus. By this, he meant, as we have seen, the potential world of the first day of creation, when nothing was yet actualized, i.e. divided into two and many, but was still one. The creation of unity by a magical procedure meant the possibility of effecting a union with the world, not with the world of multiplicity as we see it, but with a potential world, the eternal ground of all empirical being. The eternal ground of all empirical being. Just as the self is the ground and origin of the individual personality, past and present and future. On the basis of a self known by meditation and produced by alchemical means, Dorn hoped and expected to be united with the unus mundus, with the one word, world. Actually, I skipped ahead in the reading. I mentioned the unio mentalis. The unio mentalis was that beginning of activation in Dorn's alchemical philosophy with the unconscious contents, the white phase. This came to the red phase, where one really sought union with the empirical foundation of being. Jung continues. The thought Dorn expressed by the third degree of conjunction is universal. It is the relation or identity of the personal with the superpersonal Atman and of the individual Tao with the universal Tao. To the Westerner, this view appears not at all realistic and all too mystic. Above all, he cannot see why a self should become a reality when it enters into relationship with the world of the first day of creation. He has no knowledge of any world other than the empirical one. Strictly speaking, his puzzlement does not begin here. It began already with the production of the Kailun, the inner unity. Such thoughts are unpopular and distressingly nebulous. He does not know where they belong or on what they could be based. They might be true, or again, they might not. In short, his experience stops here, and with it as a rule, his understanding, and unfortunately, only too often, his willingness to learn more. I would therefore counsel the critical reader to put aside his prejudices and for once try to experience on himself the effects of the process I have described, or else to suspend judgment and admit that he understands nothing. For 30 years I have studied these psychic processes under all possible conditions and have assured myself that the alchemists, as well as the great philosophies of the East, are referring to just such experiences.